Next week, Professor Meyer of the University of California, speaking on the Conserver City, Social Effects of New Technology. And on November 25th, Dr. Margaret Ormsby on British Columbia History, A New Perspective. The program for the spring is not yet completed. If you would like one of these brochures, they aren't available, but they will be mailed to all members immediately they are available. And if you're not now a member, you may do so. You may become a member by stopping at the table on the way out afterwards. Tonight, we welcome a professor in the medical faculty of this university. Dr. Hogg is a professor of pathology and is director of this university's pulmonary research laboratory at St. Paul's. Because he is a leader in respiratory pathology research, he has drawn to this laboratory other outstanding people, and the laboratory itself has now become something of which all British Columbians ought to be proud. Dr. Hogg took his pre-medical and his MD at the University of Manitoba. He was then a medical officer in the RCAF for several years before going to McGill on a medical research council fellowship. There he took his master's degree and his PhD, and he stayed on in the Faculty of Medicine. Because while there, he became a leading lung researcher, and he was appointed a professor of pathology, and he was attached to the Royal Victoria Hospital Pathology Department. In the university year 1976-77, he was a visiting professor at Mayo, John Hopkins, the University of Manitoba, and happily at the University of British Columbia. And in September 1977, a little over a year ago, he came here as professor of pathology and as director of the pulmonary research unit. Dr. Hogg is going to speak to us on environment and breathing. Dr. Hogg.
Well, thank you very much for the kind introduction, and it is indeed a pleasure to speak to the Vancouver Institute, and also an honor to be included in the very distinguished group of physicians and scientists and notaries that have come to this forum. In choosing a topic like the environment and breathing, I will try to be as general as I can, but still try and focus on some of the very important aspects of this as we lead our ordinary and everyday lives. First of all, as we're all aware, it's extremely necessary to breathe. And it's has been said by friends that even bad breath is better than no breath at all. But as we sit here in our environment, there's about approximately 20% oxygen, and we need some of this oxygen in order for our tissues to function. In giving this talk, I'd like to stress to some degree how we obtain this oxygen from the atmosphere, but also to try and describe the evolution of the breathing apparatus and the amazing ability it's had since the inception of life to adapt to its environment. Next, if I can, I'd like to stress the importance of research in speeding up the evolutionary process to help us achieve things which under ordinary circumstances would not be achievable. If I could have the first slide, please. This is the breathing apparatus of a normal human being. And first of all, what you can see here are the conducting airways, that is, the airways that conduct the air from the trachea down through the tracheobronchial tree to the peripheral portions of the lung. Outside the lung is the chest wall, which can't be visualized in this picture, but the muscles of the chest wall really drive the breathing apparatus to draw the air that we need down the tracheobronchial tree. As we get towards the periphery of the lung, in the next slide, I'd like to show you this at a somewhat higher magnification. If we look at this as the air comes down the tracheobronchial tree, it gets out towards this feathery part of the lung where the actual gas exchange between our environment and the tissues of our body begins to take place. If we could have the next slide, we can see this in somewhat more clear fashion. First of all, here, up here are the conducting airways, which you can see. And this is the net of the lung, which allows the air that we breathe in to meet up with the blood and allows the oxygen that we need to transport across the tissue barrier and reach the blood. These individual units, which we can see here, are called alveoli. And the next slide shows these in somewhat higher magnification. Here's a single alveolus, now shown at somewhat higher magnification, and one can see the air in this space. And across this thin barrier, the gases have to pass in order to reach the red cells of the blood, which can be seen in the capillaries at this location and at this location. All animal cells, when they breathe, take up oxygen and release CO2. So that the oxygen is taken up from the atmosphere across this membrane, and the CO2 is released back into the atmosphere and is breathed out again. The next slide shows this at much higher magnification, where we see the membrane in great detail. Here's the alveolar side, that is the air side, and here is the blood side of the barrier. And these black things at the corners are individual red blood cells. So you can see the distance across the membrane is quite narrow, and gas diffuses across it to be taken up by the red cells, the oxygen that is, and the CO2 diffuses back to be breathed out into the atmosphere again. Now, if we look at our environment, in sort of a holistic sense to try and get some concept of it, I think it's fair to say that energy does for the ecology what money does for the economy. That is that the whole system really functions on the energy that comes from sunlight. The individual plants function by photosynthesis to take up CO2 from the air, which is under ordinary circumstances there in only trace amounts. The animal breathing and living off the materials that come from photosynthesis ultimately breathes back small amounts of CO2, which then re-enter the atmosphere. The CO2 in the atmosphere is not only a function of animal breathing, though, because it can be increased either by increased in amounts of such as burning of fossil fuels, and also increased in situations where photosynthesis is shut down because the CO2 then is not bound by the plant life. The next slide shows just an overview of the breathing apparatus. First of all, here's the energy coming into the photosynthesis system, and the energy takes up CO2 from the atmosphere, mixes it with water, and produces oxygen. The oxygen, on the other hand, is burned by animal respiration, and CO2 and water are produced along with heat, and the CO2 is added back to the atmosphere. In terms of some scientists, at least, are being somewhat overwhelmed and critical of the rather slow buildup of CO2 that is occurring in our atmosphere. The usual way of explaining this is the consumption of fossil fuels, which takes place in our environment, but there is also an increasing number of scientists that are worried about the CO2 that is being bound by photosynthesis. Indeed, there's an interesting group of studies which show that the photosynthesis and the binding of CO2 may be cut back in part by the destruction of our forests and the conversion of forests into food-producing crops. For agricultural crops, it turns out, do not bind CO2 to anything like the same degree as large, heavy forests do. The next slide shows some data from a measuring station that is present in Hawaii. Scientists always like to put measuring stations in nice places. And this shows the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere against the years. And one can see the steady increase and the pulsation that occurs with the fall occurring each year in the growing season when there is heavy activity in the photosynthesis side of this operation. Just what the buildup of CO2 means is probably of more importance in terms of the ability of CO2 to hold heat in, and it may have some effect on the climate of the world over the next few years. Whether this in fact occurs or not, and I shouldn't have said few years, perhaps over the next 50 years. And of course, whether or not this will really occur is somewhat speculative, and we'll probably have to wait and see. The next slide shows a picture of a man that I think we have to pay homage to as we deal with the problem of the development of the respiratory system. This indeed is Charles Darwin, a name that everyone knows, but I think a person who is most often remembered from pictures of him as a much older man when he has a beard. He was 33 years old at this time and had just returned from his 5-year voyage as a naturalist on the HMCS Beagle. It was from the diaries collected on this voyage that his famous book, The Origin of the Species, and his famous theory of evolution took place. I think the thing that I would like to stress tonight is that Darwin understood a number of things extremely well that have helped biologists, and particularly respirologists, to understand the development of the breathing system. First of all, he understood that the Earth was extremely old. He understood that evolution was an extremely gradual process, and that, most importantly, that organisms adapted to their environment so that natural selection would determine which species would survive in any particular environment. The next slide gives an overview. And I'm sorry, this probably doesn't show up that well, but let us just say that this is an overview of time. First of all, we begin with the origin of life some 3.5 billion years ago. And the point that I would like to make that in the development up to the present time, the first forms of life were completely anaerobic. That is, they did not need oxygen to live, and indeed at that time, there was no oxygen present in the environment. With the development and the emergence of life, we gradually developed an oxygen atmosphere several billion years ago. With the development of the oxygen atmosphere, this atmosphere was first toxic to living organisms, and it's indeed a cruel irony, in a sense, that the oxygen that we need to breathe becomes toxic if we get it in too high a concentration and for too long a period of time. Indeed, man's survival on Earth and the survival of animal life really has depended on the development of a system of enzymes which allow us to detoxify the oxygen products so that they're no longer harmful to us. It's interesting that from the formation of the vertebrates and land plants and the formation through amphibians to reptiles and mammals as we know them, that there's been a constant evolution and building up of the respiratory system. The fact that we now sit quietly in our chairs with a bony thorax protecting our respiratory system, with the ability to breathe oxygen in and exchange gas, with the ability to protect that from infections and protect it from all sorts of environmental insults, is really truly a function of a long period of evolution. To point out that research can sometimes speed up that evolution, I'd like to use the following analogy. If I could have the next slide, I'd like to show a picture of a book that was published about 100 years ago by Paul Baer. Paul Baer was a scientist of considerable renown. It's interesting that he was the son of a lawyer who first went to Paris to study law and became interested in zoology while he was a lawyer studying law. Just how lawyers become interested in zoology, I don't really know. But I think it was of great benefit to us that Paul Baer did become interested in zoology. He completed his law degree in 1857, and at the age of 23, proceeded to study natural sciences, passing his examinations for the licentiate in 1860, and becoming an MD in 1863. While an MD, or while obtaining his MD, he wrote an important thesis on the transplantation of animal tissues. And indeed, plastic surgeons applied his findings in repairing mutilated soldiers in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. And today's renal transplant surgeons might consider him the father of their field, for his study of tissue acceptance and rejection can be considered at least as great an accomplishment as his study of oxygen in our atmosphere. This is a picture of Paul Baer. And in addition to some of the other things that he did, he was really the first to demonstrate that nitrous oxide could produce deep anesthesia. And his method of delivering nitrous oxide has stimulated the present development of things that are used in our operating rooms by anesthetists to the present day. Subsequently, he devoted much of his energy to political life and became a member of the National Assembly, played a major role in reforming the French system of public education, and became the Minister of Education when his party formed the cabinet in 1881. He encouraged the teaching of science in the public schools and himself wrote a number of scientific textbooks, some of which went through many editions. At the age of 53, he died of dysentery just a few months after he had arrived in Hanoi. And he'd been sent to Hanoi by the French government as the governor general, charged with the necessity of de-emphasizing the French military control of Vietnam and forming a government that would be more acceptable to the Vietnamese. Unfortunately, he died before he had been in Vietnam for very long. This slide shows Baer's experimental apparatus in his laboratory and indicates how he studied that oxygen was important. First of all, he had a bell jar, which he was able to evacuate through this chamber and lower the barometric pressure around his experimental animal. He was also able to measure the barometric chamber in the bell jar using this simple apparatus. In addition, he had a bag of oxygen which connected to the bell jar, and his experimental approach was to drop the pressure around the animal, and at the pressure that the animal became unconscious, the bird became unconscious and fell over, he would then open the stopcock and resuscitate it by allowing oxygen to enter the chamber. He did these experiments in an extremely rigorous fashion, and here are his results from many, many experiments. First of all, he has the percentage of oxygen in the atmosphere going from about what we're breathing now, that is about 20% oxygen, and he showed that at a normal pressure, which is shown here, the normal barometric pressure of around sea level, shown here in inches of mercury, that animals became unconscious, that is, these M and C and G stands for the bird, a guinea pig, and a frog, which he experimented on, and he showed that when the oxygen, or when the atmospheric pressure was dropped, so that it was about 2% of an atmosphere, these animals became unconscious. He then showed that as he lowered the barometric pressure, that the animals became unconscious at higher and higher percentages of oxygen. Now, Baer not only did animal experiments, indeed, as a true physiologist, he did many, many experiments on himself. And this is a picture of his laboratory and the chamber in which he studied the decompression of himself and the apparatus that he had for lowering the pressure in this large chamber. This is an example of an experiment carried out by Dr. Baer on Dr. Baer. It shows along this axis the barometric pressure and the pulse rate. Now, you can see that his pulse rate was about 60 beats per minute, which indicates that he was an extremely relaxed person and certainly had a pulse rate that is much lower than mine at the present time. However, as the barometric pressure was dropped using this apparatus, one can see that his pulse rate picked up, and at this point he began to breathe oxygen and showed that his pulse rate, among other things, dropped back to the normal level and remained there even though the barometric pressure continued to fall, and this was the pressure that he thought was present at about on the highest mountain peak at that particular point. He did many other experiments, both on himself and on others, but unfortunately, I think, these experimental results were used by a group of adventurers, perhaps before they were really ready for them, before they should have been taken out of the laboratory. This shows the ascent of the Zenith, which was a balloon carrying two of the people that Paul Baer had used as experimental subjects. The three of them, Seville, Tissandier, and Croque Spinelli, took off in the Zenith with these bags of oxygen And here is shown the simple apparatus used for bubbling the oxygen, allowing them to breathe. One of these intrepid investigators is seen busily reading the gauges as they ascend, and the other one is shown in a period when he was conscious. I say that purposefully because with this ascent, two of these investigators died, and only one survived this particular ascent. I think as you can imagine, this caused great troubles and consternation and letters in the press, great criticism of Dr. Baer for putting these men in this condition or allowing them to develop the reasoning that they felt they could ascend using oxygen to help them. In his own defense, in later life, he published letters which he had written to them, telling them that he felt they had grossly miscalculated the amount of oxygen that they would need in order to make this ascent, and that he had indicated in these letters very strongly that he didn't feel that the technology had been developed to the point for them to undertake such a courageous undertaking. As we leave these intrepid astronauts, the next slide shows the real astronaut, the landing of man on the moon, which has taken place during our lifetime under conditions where the environment of the person, particularly the oxygen that he needs, can be completely controlled along with his body temperature and the deposition of his waste. Clearly, the experiments of Dr. Baer greatly facilitated the evolution of our ability to send a man to the moon. It was through his basic experiments that we developed the know-how and the need to show that the needs of the man could be met. However, his experiments, the results of experiments, were probably removed from the laboratory perhaps a little too early to help the people that he had actually carried out experiments on. To leave the need for oxygen for a minute, I'd like to discuss some other insults that can occur to the respiratory tract and arrive from our environment. I think we could all agree this is a picture of a man sneezing, taken in such a way to indicate just exactly what happens when you sneeze. I think we've all had the experience of having our head just about in this position in a movie theater and having the person behind us sneeze and have this tremendous jettison of water land on the back of our neck. I think the other thing about the sneeze that it does carry forth all of the organisms which are present in our upper respiratory tract and nose and mouth out into these droplets, and as the water evaporates from the droplets, the organisms are present in the atmosphere for us to breathe. The next slide shows the Seattle police force masked. Now, this doesn't mean that they've been converted to robbing banks, but it does mean that this picture was taken in 1918 during the influenza epidemic that swept the world. And this was an attempt by these men to protect themselves from the respiratory infections that was sweeping the world at that time. Influenza has been called the great plague of man. Certainly the pandemic that took place at this time which raced around the world in three waves, killing upward of 20 million people, left enormous social and economic disruption, and ranks as one of the most devastating afflictions of any kind in human history. The individual symptoms and epidemiological traits of the disease were sufficiently characteristic to enable us to identify a number of major epidemics in the distant past. One such epidemic was recorded by Hippocrates, the father of medicine, in 412 BC, and numerous episodes were described in the Middle Ages. The term influenza was introduced in Italy in the 15th century to describe an epidemic that was attributed to the influence of the stars. And the term was adapted by the English during that period. During the same period, the French named the disease La Grippe, and a colorful and accurate description of the main characteristics of influenza is contained in a letter sent from Edinburgh by Lord Randolph to Lord Cecil in November of 1562. "May it please your honor," he said, "immediately upon the Queen's," that is Queen Mary's, "arrival, she fell acquainted with a new disease that is common in this town, called here the new acquaintance, which also passed through her whole court, neither sparing lords, ladies, nor damsels, nor no such as either the French or the English. It is a plague in their heads, with a soreness in their stomachs, with a great cough that remaineth with some longer, and with others a shorter time. The Queen was kept to her bed for 6 days. There was no appearance of danger. Ashamed to say that I have been free of it." Why he should be ashamed of being free of it is not exactly clear to me. In any event, if we look at this particular epidemic of 1918, we see that we have something here that is completely different than this benign illness that was referred to by this letter. Some years ago, while I was in Montreal, I had the opportunity to collect some material, statistics from Montreal that recorded the epidemic at that time. Along this axis, we show the deaths in Montreal per week through the period of September 22, 1918, to January 12, 1919. And here, in the week of October the 20th, we list some 1,300 deaths in a single week. The population of Montreal at that time was some 640,000 people. There were 29,000 cases presented, and there were some 3,600 deaths. To the Royal Victoria Hospital at that time, which had 200 beds set aside for the epidemic, there were 517 admissions, 102 deaths, 37 of which were autopsied. And when I reviewed those autopsies in about 1970, I was amazed to find that the average age of death was something like 25 years. You can imagine what would happen to the medical facilities in our city if we have a population of 1.2 million, if we were faced with some 2,600 deaths in a single week. Surely influenza of this magnitude is a much different disease than the common influenza which we're all accustomed to. And it is of interest to think just why that might be so. One of the theories about how it could be so is the fact that when viruses that commonly infect man and sometimes infect animals both infect a single animal, that is a pig, that there can be the two viruses in a single cell with a recombination of the genetic material from the viruses to produce viruses that no one has any experience with. So we get a virus that is out, let loose in the community, which no one has any immunity to, and it has the ability, it is believed, to form large pandemics. It's of interest that the recent pandemics that we've seen in 57 and in 69 started in areas of the world where man lives in fairly close association with animals. And the question naturally arises as to whether the 1918 pandemic strain emerged from pigs or from some other animal reservoir, or whether it infected pigs for the first time in that year, as was maintained by veterinarians working in the Midwestern United States at that time. It's particularly intriguing that the first definitely observed cluster of human influenza in the United States in March of 1918 was in Fort Riley, and that this overcrowded camp drew many of its recruits from young farm workers in the Middle Western states. More recently, in January of 1976, a swine strain was identified in those in pigs in several parts of the U.S. But in Fort Dix, a soldier died of influenza, and a swine influenza strain was isolated from his tissue. This strain was also recovered from five other cases of influenza among service personnel at Fort Dix. Just before the Fort Dix episode, an 8-year-old boy and members of his family in Wisconsin also became ill with swine influenza at a time when swine influenza was found to be present in pigs that were present on their farm. It then became possible in the minds of some to think, because of the experience with the 1918 flu epidemic, that we might be in for another such epidemic at that time. And I think we can remember President Ford coming on television saying that they were going to develop a strain of vaccine and so that every man, woman, and child in the United States would be protected. Similar attempts were made in Canada to develop these vaccines. And unfortunately, as we all now know, that particular epidemic never materialized. And I think to the great embarrassment of the National Institutes of Health in the United States and to many others, large sums of money were spent trying to prevent an epidemic which never occurred. The point that I'd like to make from all this is that at the time that these attempts were made, we were very much, and still are, in the hypothesis stage about why these epidemics actually occurred, so that again we see the application of science or an attempt to transform science out of the laboratory to our everyday life at a time when it is really, when we're really not prepared for that. This is, to move to another area, a picture of Edmonton in the winter months. And I think in many ways it's an unfair picture. And I chose it from a collection that Dr. Bates so kindly lent me, largely because my wife comes from Edmonton and I like to rub it in. But it's really unfair to show a picture like this because much of the material emanating from the smokestack is really water vapor and of no real consequence in causing disease. However, from industrial pollution sites, and this happens to be an electricity generating station in the center of Edmonton, which generates electricity and this sort of material up into the skies. Now, in this sort of pollution, we can have particulate matter, and we can have gases that come up that can do damage to the human respiratory system. The fact that this is so was perhaps best illustrated by the mortality from the sulfur dioxide during the London smogs of 1952. This is the total daily deaths in London that is shown in the closed dots. And this is the atmospheric sulfur dioxide concentration shown in the open circles. And you can see that during this period, when the sulfur dioxide concentration rose in the atmosphere, that there was at that time a similar increase in the death rate amongst the London population. So clearly, the atmospheric pollution, to a degree that can be as serious as this, can produce death in patients, perhaps those patients whose respiratory systems are also somewhat compromised by other from other avenues, such as tobacco smoke producing chronic lung disease. But in any event, atmospheric pollution through sulfur dioxide can be an extremely dangerous thing in our environment. If we look at this map of the United States, it shows the incidence of cancer throughout the United States, in non-white males, and the relative cancer rates in various parts of the country. In this same study, these cancer rates were related to a number of industries that were present in a variety of the counties. First of all, this shows the mortality rate per 100,000 population. And here in the open bars, we have counties with no paper industry, counties with less than 1% employed in the paper industry, and counties with more than 1% employed in the paper industry. And again, if we look at this data with respect to the urbanization of the counties, that is, on this group of slides, we have very little urbanization. And over on this side, we have the areas that are the counties which are more than 75% urban. This indicates that there is a very slight and hardly measurable increase in lung cancer that is related to occupation in the percentage of people occupied in the paper industry, and that there also appears to be a moderate interaction with this industrial pollution and the urbanization of the particular county in which it occurs. I think it's fair to say, though, these changes are extremely small and barely statistically significant. So that the message that I'd like to give you, that in terms of this particular regard, the problems with industrial pollution of our atmosphere are probably relatively small in comparison to the problems that arise from the pollutants of our own personal atmosphere, particularly that of the provided by the cigarette. If we look at lung cancer rates here, or cancer rates in man, to show a number of cancers, that is the esophagus, the lung, the colon, the stomach, leukemia, cancers of the prostate, pancreas, and bladder, over the periods of 1930 up here into the 1970s, one fact I think everyone can agree on, and that is the remarkable rise in lung cancer amongst males that has taken place during this time period. If we look at the consumption of tobacco products with regard to that, here we have the weight of tobacco in pounds, showing the overall consumption of tobacco by men, which was at this level when the cigarette was introduced in 1890, and shows the consumption of cigarettes with a linear increase up until about the end of the Second World War. One can see the effect of war on the consumption of tobacco and show that there was a considerable increase during the period of the First World War. You'll remember that the increase in cancer amongst men started in around this period, some 20 or so years after cigarette smoking really became widespread within the population. It's also of interest that consumption of cigarettes by women, shown in this curve, and the increase that occurred in women during the period of the Second World War. If we now look at the incidence of a variety of cancers in women, here shown the uterus, the lung, and the same cancers, if we follow lung cancer in women, we can see the marked increase here beginning in the 1960s, again with about the same lag period between the increase in lung cancer and the consumption of large amounts of tobacco smoke from the cigarette. If we look at the survival rate with the commonest method of treatment, that is the lung cancer surgery, I think that it's fair to say that the only curative method we have for lung cancer perhaps is lung surgery, although there are some encouraging signs in the area of chemotherapy. But recently, the group at the Massachusetts General Hospital have reviewed their figures for 3 decades for lung cancer surgery. Here we show the results from 1941 to 1950, 51 to 60, and 61 to 70, with the survival from removing a whole lung, that is the survival for 5 years following the attempt at curing the surgery, or curing the cancer with surgery, the effect of pneumonectomy, and the effect of lobectomy, and the effect of all of these resections. And I think it's very clear that while we found from 1941 to 50 that we got about a 30% 5-year cure rate for all of lung cancers, and indeed from 1961 to 70, we similarly got a 30% cure rate. So that if there ever was an area where we needed an advance, or we need an advance, it's in our approach to both the treatment and the prevention of this rapidly increasing disease, because the methods which we have now are clearly not adequate to deal with it in any sort of reasonable sense at all. If we come back now to the normal tracheobronchial tree, which we saw at the beginning, the normal branch patterns, I'd like you to compare this with an abnormal bronchial tree that is seen in a patient that has chronic bronchitis and central lobular emphysema. Now, emphysema is a destruction of the lung in the peripheral, in its most peripheral parts. And here I think you can see at the periphery of the lung, rather than being nice and tapered, you can now see these little balls that are hanging on the bronchial tree. And this reminded the first pathologist when they looked at them of Lily of the Valley. And indeed in the older literature, that rather descriptive term is applied to this condition, or to the description of these bronchograms. When you look at that under slightly higher magnification, one can see the peripheral part of the lung, the terminal bronchiole, coming down, and this large area which has allowed the contrast material to enter into it. What that in fact is, when you look at the whole lung, are holes that are punched out in the lung surface, which represent the destruction of the lung surface by the disease which we call emphysema. If you look at that under a dissecting microscope, you get a rather pretty picture. That is, here we have the normal lung out in the periphery, and we have this destroyed area in the center of the lung lobule outlined here. Once we've reached the level of destruction of the lung surface, of course, that it is difficult, if not impossible, for that to be repaired, although the disease can clearly be managed by maximizing the ability of the remainder of the lung to function. So that we have a situation now where Marlborough country, which has been described and used so often to describe a particular brand of cigarettes, has been classified by a colleague of mine, Dr. Thurlbeck, who now lives in Winnipeg, by another sort of Marlborough country, which clearly represents the graveyard for a large number of people who have been exposed to the problems of tobacco smoke. Now, I hate to leave with such a depressing atmosphere as that of a graveyard. And I think it's fair to say that this is perhaps an overreaction to the problems of tobacco smoking. And we may indeed be watching evolution in progress at this particular point in time. Indeed, we all know people who have smoked all of their lives and neither get chronic bronchitis or emphysema, nor do they get lung cancer. And indeed, a relatively small number of the people who smoke heavily actually get these diseases. I think that there are some interesting areas where we're gradually developing the knowledge of how the environment, and particularly this environment of our own personal pollutants, works on us. And there are some encouraging studies, particularly from the group at Texas at the MD Anderson Hospital, who've shown now that some people have the ability to take the very minor cancer-producing materials that are in tobacco smoke and convert them to major cancer-producing materials. And they have this ability through an enzyme which is genetically or thought to be genetically determined within them. And that the ability or the unfortunate ability to induce this enzyme by tobacco smoke may be the thing that converts minor carcinogens to major carcinogens, and it may be only the people who have this unfortunate ability that are at risk to the development of lung cancer. The hope then would be that we can identify these people and use the anti-smoking system or anti-smoking campaigns in a more effective way to try and remove the personal pollutants from the very people who are most likely to develop lung cancer. Similarly, in chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, there is some evidence that this disease occurs at an early and undetectable stage, or barely detectable stage, and there is a great deal of research at the present time aimed at the possibility of detecting it at a time when it could be where it could be reversed. There is also some evidence that it's again a particular group of people who are affected with chronic obstructive lung disease, and if we had the ability to know who they were, again we could take steps, common sense steps, in order to try and have them avoid the problem of tobacco smoke. So that, in closing, I'd like to say that I think that there, the importance of the evolution of the respiratory system and the evolution of our ability to breathe taking place to allow us to deal with an extremely complex environment. Perhaps if we lived long enough, evolution would take care of the problem of tobacco smoke. That is, the only people left by natural selection would be those who wouldn't be involved with the induction of the enzymes which produce these major carcinogens. However, I think with the intelligent application of research, we may be able to speed up the evolutionary process and hopefully find those people who are at risk to this pollution in our environment. Thank you very much.
Dr. Hogg has agreed to take questions. I don't think that involves your particular ailment of the moment. Yes? Yes?
Well, it's an extremely complex question, and you can only deal with one thing at a time. In terms of the damage to, it seems likely that the mechanisms involved to producing lung cancer in a patient are quite different than the mechanisms involved that produce atherosclerosis or damage to the vessels in another patient who smokes, and it seems unlikely that the prevention of one particular thing would be particularly related to another, but it could be. Certainly, if your only ability to fix the situation is to have them stop smoking, which is clearly the only real thing we have now, the only thing that this would allow us to do is focus the anti-smoking campaign on those who need it worse. But if you removed him from the smoking environment, you would, to some degree, prevent the development of those other diseases.
Well, I'd like to ask a question.
Yeah, we've got one here ahead of you.
You ready for me? Yeah, I've got a special message, Dr. Ott, for adolescents who appear to be succumbing to the advertising to smoke.
Well, no, I don't. I don't. I think that it's just human nature, in a sense, that when you know something is dangerous and the danger is a long ways off, if you remember what it was like when we were adolescents, you always liked to do something that was a little risky. And I think that this has been used by some psychologists that I've talked to as the reason for why, you know, in increasing numbers, adolescents seem to be taking up the smoking habit. That it does seem, you know, there's so much focused on that this is bad for them, but yet the diseases occur at an age which when they're adolescents, they don't ever believe they're going to reach. It's the idea of doing something that's a little dangerous that is contributory to them starting smoking.
Next question.
To say something about asthma. Asthma is an extremely complex disease, which is certainly probably made worse by smoking. If one of the problems with asthma is people with it have hyper-irritable airways, that is that their airways become irritated and constrict and cause them trouble breathing at levels of irritation which don't bother the ordinary person. So that cigarette smoke to an asthmatic can be an extremely irritating situation for them to be in. And when asthmatics smoke, their airways function is obviously much worse than when they don't smoke. That's perhaps an overgeneralization, but you asked for a few words.
Yes, sir.
one did, Dr. Hogg, and one lives for the last 16 years downwind from a new a plant that was opened after one built one's house that exudes poisonous fumes and makes one feel very ill and also gives you pain. Now that is a pleasure, and that is taking risks voluntarily.
Well, I think you have to be, in terms of the amount of pollution that's put into the atmosphere by industrial situations, I think it's an extremely complex subject. And the in terms of the ability, first of all, we need information on actual measurements of pollutant gases in the area that is supposed to cause disease over the time course that the disease occurs. And of course, these measurements are extremely difficult to come by. And also that we, you know, the evidence that we have from living in these areas along the lines of studies which I showed, you can often measure changes in disease rates. But my point is that these changes are really relatively small when compared to the personal pollutants that you have through cigarette smoke. Really quite small indeed. That doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't be very, very conscious of the fact that industries are developing and the fact that industry can produce air pollution, but I think that we really need a balanced approach in terms of the jobs that the industry provides, and it really, to my mind, presents an extremely complex group of facts, which is very difficult to make judgments about.
This gentleman?
You said that minor carcinogens can be converted into major carcinogens in certain individuals. Is there any hereditary factor involved in that? If so, would you recommend that the reproduction be limited to such of those people who
well, first.
The second question is, you said about personal pollutants and industrial pollutants. Will you just explain why the industrial pollutants are not so dangerous as the personal?
Well, first of all, to go back to your first question about the enzymes and the converting of minor carcinogens to major carcinogens and whether it's genetic or not. Well, let me stress that these experiments are very much at the hypothesis stage. And the idea was put forward by a man named Kellerman in MD Anderson Hospital, who showed that patients with lung cancer, that their cells had the ability to make an enzyme when stressed that would convert a minor carcinogen to a major carcinogen. Now, if they had the genetic material to produce that enzyme, that is to have that enzyme induced, then it would obviously be something that would be genetically determined. One of the detractions from the hypothesis that was recently published in the New